Sure.
Any other cell phones? I would request that you turn them off before you come into the hall. That way they won't be a distraction as we have our class. Let us begin.
Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahavidyam Karavavahai Tejasvi Navadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Oh, God. Very good. Welcome back. Are any of you coming tonight for the first time? Would you raise your hands, please? Okay. Oh, a lot of you. My gosh. Yeah. Okay. Well, I understand your schedules. The previous class, the introduction was extremely important. In fact, generally, when a text like this requires continuity, I would encourage you, I know you have very busy schedules, I would encourage you to be as regular as possible. I'd encourage you, when you miss a class, to catch up by getting the tape or MP3. Tapes are available in our office. The procedure is up there on the wall. MP3s are posted to our website. There'll be some delay before we can manage to post the MP3s, so be aware that there may be a week or two delay after the lecture. Also, my voice is a little funny tonight, so please bear with me, and we may keep this class a little bit on the short side. One other note is we'd like to find a way to incorporate question and answers into this session. It's been my experience with a group this size, it doesn't work well to take questions from the floor. If there's a small group of us, it's wonderful to have that very informal dialogue. But when a group gets fairly large, it doesn't seem to work very well. So what I would request is, please come with your questions. You can write them down and deposit them in this basket. I put out the basket today. I don't see any questions in there. So if you'd like to address a question, you can write it down, leave it in that basket, or you can email me, as some of you already do. So if you email me, and then I can take up those questions. If you do, please specify that it is a question for this class. I get a lot of questions, so just specify that it's a question for the Narada Bhakti Sutra class. Last class, we talked about several things, most of which we don't want to go over again. We talked about the text, we talked about Narada, we talked about bhakti in general and how it fits into a life of spiritual growth. Those topics I don't think we'll want to go over once again, but let me review one portion of last week's talk, which we'll then introduce to we'll finish up the introduction here briefly, and then we'll proceed with the first of the sutras in this Narada Bhakti Sutra. In the previous class, we had developed a, can't call it a sequence, but we were comparing three different kinds of love, so to speak. We compared kama, prema, and bhakti. And we went on to define these three words. We're trying, of course, to understand what is bhakti. And en route to that definition, we talked about kama, we can call desire, or even in this context, I feel embarrassed to put a word like this on the board, but it's suggested by the word. It's a physical form of desire, as opposed to prema, which we spent perhaps half an hour in our last class trying to define prema, and we'll return to it again today. But for the time being, let us just simply put it as love. And which leaves us with another, then if we're going to call kama desire and call prema love, then what shall we what word shall we use for bhakti? Well, this is one of the real problems, that a lot of Sanskrit words have no exact English equivalents. Or to borrow one of my Guruji's jokes, if you want to translate bhakti into English, maybe, you know, usually the way it'll translate into English as bhakti, which is bhakti with an American accent. The point is that the concept is not necessarily translatable. We can call it love for God. We can call it divine love. But I would suggest these are not definitions. They're just suggestive phrases. We're going to have to see this much more. One thing we can say that definitely distinguishes these three is the object. What is the object of desire? What is the object of love? And what is the object of this divine love? And this, at first thought, seems obvious, ends up being a little trickier than you think. Suppose we recognize that the object of kama, desire, let us, going a little bit more with this second meaning, let's say it's more dealing with our physical desires. Yeah, just in general. By the way, kama can refer to other things. This is silly to say, but it's true. Going out to a fancy restaurant because you really have a craving for a particular kind of food, that's a kama. That kind of craving, a physical craving, doesn't, you know, whatever is the nature of that physical craving correctly can be called kama, which you would distinguish then very much from prema. Prema not having anything to do with a physical craving, but shall we call it an emotional craving. We'll develop that. Physical craving, we don't need to talk further about, but emotional craving. This is one part of last week's talk that we should repeat. Because our conventional concept of love is often very limited. It certainly is not what we would call unconditional love. Unconditional love is only giving. Giving with zero expectations. Zero means zero, not a single expectation. And this kind of prema, this kind of love, must be the rarest thing in the world. There's plenty of conventional love. We thank goodness there is so much conventional love in the world. But we discussed at some length in our previous class that this conventional love is very rarely selfless or unconditional because our needs are always involved. And we discussed in our previous class, even the love for a parent for their children, even that love contains some degree of self-interest. Not a lot, but some degree. Parents want their kids to come up. Parents need their kids to come up. It's a real attachment. It's a real desire on the part of the parents. And certainly it's normal and it's appropriate. There's nothing wrong with it. All we want to do here is identify that what we conventionally understand as prema or love is not unconditional. It's not selfless. It's to some measure intermixed with one's own desires. And that shouldn't be surprising. Do you have any desires? No? Suppose you did. Come on. Every human being who is not yet enlightened is afflicted and manipulated by varieties of their own desires. That's a human condition. If you're a normal human being, much of your life's activities are dictated by your desires. Up to and including coming here this evening is driven by your own desire. In this case, a desire for spiritual growth, which is a wonderful desire, but a desire nonetheless. Human behavior is driven by desire. This is such a fundamental recognition. Buddha, as we said in a different class, Buddha is one who began his teachings with the recognition of the problem of desire, and that the ancient rishis, long before Buddha, recognized this truth, and that is that all... Whenever I use the word all, I stop myself. Because the word all is dangerous, especially in a class like this, because all is a very far-reaching statement. So if I'm going to use the word all, I double and triple check myself. I just did, and I gave myself permission to use the word all in the following statement, and that is, all conventional human behavior is driven by desire. This is Vedanta. And for those of you who missed our last class, we said that our Bhakti Sutra class is a Vedanta class. Don't let the title fool you. Vedanta is what we teach here in this ashram. So even though the focal point will be this text, Bhakti Sutra, our approach will clearly be a Vedantic approach. So we have many desires which we seek to fulfill. How do we seek to fulfill those desires? Kama. Through physical relationships, through physical satisfaction, through physical pleasures. How else do we seek to fulfill those desires? Prema, emotional satisfaction. If kama is for the sake of physical satisfaction, can we not say that prema is for the sake of one's emotional satisfaction? Now, that even means when we give to others, when we love others. Doesn't it satisfy us? Don't we get something? Even if they give us nothing in return. Did you ever hug someone who just stands there? They're just standing there like a stick. You hug them. Yeah, you'd prefer that they hug you back, I suppose. But even still, you have some satisfaction in sharing your affection with that person. So there is some emotional satisfaction for you. Now, before we proceed to the last of the three, bhakti, we want to see a commonality between the three. For the most part, as we discussed in the previous class, the three are utterly different. Utterly means completely. No similarity whatsoever between a physical kind of kama, between an emotional kind of prema, which is really going to lead us now to the question, well, what is bhakti? If bhakti is not... We're going to define bhakti. We'll start shortly. Bhakti, which is not emotional. Conventional idea is bhakti is all emotional. You know, if you have bhakti, tears must be streaming down your cheeks every time you pray. And if you don't shed a tear, what's wrong with you? Where is your bhakti? As we will see, and we'll see this unfolding slowly through many classes, bhakti is much more than emotions. Must be much more than emotions, because if bhakti is only about your emotions, we have a huge problem. What kind of bhakti should we have? What kind of devotion to God should we have? Should we have a devotion to God that comes and goes very freely, spontaneously, or should we have a bhakti that's dridha, that's firm, that's abiding, that's constant? Obviously, we should have an abiding, constant bhakti. Look at this. If bhakti is an emotion, is it possible they have an unchanging emotion. Have you ever had an unchanging emotion? As sad as you are, it doesn't last forever. Sooner or later, you get sick and tired of being sad, and you come back up. As happy as you are, you can't maintain that happiness forever. Eventually, you'll come down. No matter how angry you are at a given person, eventually that anger is going to fade away. It's not possible to have a permanent, constant, abiding emotion. If bhakti is an emotion, will it abide? No. Some of you will remember when I told about Pujya Swami Dayananda's funny expression of this, where he describes the person who looks at bhakti merely as emotion. The person goes and stands in front of the altar and is caught up in this devotional fervor, tears streaming down the cheeks, all of this, and then the moment they walk out of the temple, they don't think about God at all until the next time they come into the temple, which could be many days or even weeks in between visits to the temple. So Pujya Swamiji asks, what's going on with this person? They stand in front of the temple and they have this intense fit. These are his words. They have a fit of devotion. He says further, it's like having a spasm of devotion, making them a spasmodic devotee. His term. A spasmodic devotee is one who stands in some sacred place and is overcome with that emotion of devotion, but then as soon as they walk away, it fades away just as quickly. This is the problem. If bhakti is no more than an emotion. Are emotions involved? Most certainly emotions are involved. And we're going to see that as we develop this. We're going to be meeting here on Tuesday nights for quite a while. There are 84 sutras. To go through these 84 sutras, I'm sure we'll spend at least half a year of weekly classes to go through this text. So be a little patient to see the big picture. What we want to see tonight is what does Narada, the author of this text, how does he understand bhakti? And what we're developing is it's not your conventional concept of what bhakti is. In fact, before proceeding, this might be helpful to suggest that we all set aside our conventional definitions of what is bhakti. One of the biggest problems in learning something new is our heads are so full of what we think we know that nothing new goes in. This is a very common problem, not just in spiritual life, but in any realm of life. Did you ever sit with somebody and try to explain something to them, and they say, no, I know how it works. And they're so totally confused. And you say, no, it doesn't. And they say, no, leave me alone. I know exactly how it works. And you see them making mistakes and things are going badly. This is a common problem. When we think we know, nothing goes in. One of the best things we can do as spiritual seekers is to set aside our preconceptions and open ourselves to seeing things newly. Now, please be careful here. When I say to set aside your preconceptions and listen with a fresh mind, this is not to say that we should become somehow full of such faith that we will believe or swallow anything that the teacher says. That is not desirable, in my opinion. What we're engaged in is a process of inquiry. Faith is a wonderful quality, but if you come here on Tuesday nights and merely believe whatever we discuss, we've made a terrible mistake. because what we're engaged in, as I said, is a process of inquiry. The goal is not to believe what we discuss here. The goal is for you to undergo that process of inquiry, for you to discover what the ancient rishis discovered, for you to discover what this Rishi Narad discovered with regard to bhakti. So the attitude we're after here is one of openness, one of inquiry, but not one of being submissive and ready to believe anything and everything. To me, that is not a helpful attitude at all. Okay, and let's finish this up now. So bhakti, to summarize that, whatever you think bhakti is, it's not that. Let's find out what is bhakti. What we just developed is each of these three are utterly different than the other two. You know in your personal life how different kama and prema are. This is a good way of understanding. Just as kama is different from prema, or let me put it the other way, just as prema is different from kama, in the same way, bhakti is different from prema. That different. All right. So with that, we can finish up. What is the connection then? Why do we even use the word love at all for all three of these? In some context, any of these three could be called love. Kama can be called love. Prema can be called love. Bhakti can be called love. Suggesting there must be something unifying the three. And we'll see this, and this will be the completion of our introduction. We said a few minutes ago that what drives conventional human behavior is desire. This is a very Vedantic perspective. Let's do this briefly. It's so important, we shouldn't gloss over this one. One of the most startling discoveries of the ancient rishis is why we have desire. That we have desire seems so obvious. That's the human condition. The rishis were bold enough to ask, why do we have desire? And what came from that inquiry is, really speaking, Vedanta, our spiritual teachings. Here's what they taught. Desire is a result of a sense of lack, a sense of incompleteness, a sense of insufficiency. Think about it in any realm of life. If you had as much money as Bill Gates, would you have financial desires? No. So based on, you look at your bank account and you see it's, quite honestly, it's inadequate. It's not enough. Based on that sense of inadequacy comes desire. Set the bank account aside, we're talking about ourselves. When you evaluating your bank account is one thing. Evaluate yourself now. Take stock of yourself. An accounting of yourself. Physically, emotionally, spiritually, take stock of yourself. Is the bottom line completely acceptable to you or not? Looks like it's a little inadequate. It's insufficient. It's incomplete. This is so fundamental to human beings. We look at ourselves, and as much as we've accomplished, as much as we're blessed in this life, we see so many areas of lack, of incompleteness, of inadequacy. Based on those perceived areas of inadequacy, we feel desire. If you looked at yourself and you saw nothing but perfection, what would you desire? Think about it. If you looked in the mirror, and this sounds so silly, you look in a mirror and you say, "Vah, perfect. Who will ever look in the mirror and see perfect? No one is going to see perfect. So, any aspect of our lives we reflect upon, we see areas of incompleteness, inadequacy. And whatever we see as incomplete, insufficient, we want to fill it up. We want to make up for those insufficiencies, those inadequacies. Wherever there's a lack, we want to fill it. Wherever there's something missing, we want to bring it in. Wherever we're a little lacking, you know, whatever is not there, we want it to be present. Or conversely, sometimes we see problems and we want the problems to go away. In order to be okay, I need the problems to go away. A very simple way of saying this is we all seek contentment. Now, contentment is a very loose, general word. What we've just done is define contentment with a little bit of care. What do you mean by contentment? Contentment is to feel okay exactly as you are. Very simple. What does it mean to be content? It means to be okay exactly as you are. It means to be okay with the situation exactly as it is. It means to be okay.
Pardon me.
It means to be okay without changing anything. How can you be okay when you look in the mirror and you don't say perfect? How can you be okay when you reflect on your life, what you've lived and what's ahead for you, and you don't see it's perfect? You see normal problems. Normal problems. How can we be okay when we see ourselves as incomplete, inadequate, insufficient? We can never see ourselves as okay. Therefore, we are never completely content, or whatever contentment we have comes and goes. This is what drives desire. And we seek to fulfill that desire. How? Kama, prema, and bhakti. Kama is an attempt to fulfill desires. Let us say very simply, physical desires are fulfilled through kama. Then we have emotional desires. We seek to fulfill those emotional desires. We fulfill them through prema. To have physical and emotional desires is absolutely normal. Every conventional human being has lots of physical and emotional desires. This is a human condition. So far we see kama is the drive to fulfill physical desires, prema, the fulfillment of emotional desires, bhakti. Where do you go from here? You can't say spiritual desire, because the words spiritual and desire don't go together. That's what they say, oxymoron. Oxymoron is a term, two words that don't fit together. So we can't call them spiritual desires. Let's just hint, and we're going to see this in just a moment, especially when we get to the second of the sutras, we'll see it in more detail, but just a hint about it. If kama is seeking, can I say seeking fullness? Previously we were using negative words. We use words like inadequacy, filling our inadequacies, insufficiencies, lack. Turn it around. Seeking fulfillment. Kama, seeking physical fulfillment. Prema, seeking emotional fulfillment. All we did is we substituted a positive expression for a negative expression. Kama, seeking physical fullness. Prema, seeking emotional fullness. Bhakti, discovering the true source of fullness. Or even better, discovering you are already full, discovering that the God of the cosmos that you seek in your spiritual life is already here now, abiding within you as a source of happiness, contentment, peace, and love. You already have what you want. This is a Vedantic message. and we'll be developing this as we continue. Most of you have attended our other classes and have already heard these teachings. But this introduction really encapsulates in a very brief manner some of the central introductory teachings of Vedanta, introductory teachings that really spell out what is the fundamental problem. So just to summarize it, what, according to the ancient rishis, what is the fundamental problem? A sense of lack, a sense of incompleteness. What do we do to fulfill that sense of lack or incompleteness? Kama, we seek physical fulfillment. Prema, we seek emotional fulfillment. But in spiritual life, we recognize that no matter how much physical fulfillment you get, will that be enough? When will you have enough physical fulfillment that you're absolutely content for the rest of your life? That's silly. When will you have enough prema, enough emotional fulfillment, that you know that you will be utterly content every moment of every day for as long as you live? These sound silly because they come and go. A desire gets fulfilled, another desire arises. That desire gets fulfilled, another desire arises. Therefore, bhakti is a pursuit of fulfillment in a radically different way. We could say, just to conclude our introduction, kama and prema, the objects of kama and prema are out there. The object of kama is something physical, a person, food, whatever is essential enjoyment. The object of prema, emotion, and generally that's fulfilled through a relationship with a person, not always, but generally it's pursued through a relationship with a person. So again, the object of prema is outside. The object of kama is outside. The object of prema is outside. The object of bhakti, and here's where you must drop your conventional idea, because immediately you're going to think, yeah, and the object of bhakti is Bhagavan, is God, Uparvala. That Hindi expression is so indicative. He's the one up there. That's a common expression, I know. But here's where we have to give up some of our common understandings. Because in the view of the ancient rishis, bhakti, if kama and prema have the objects outside, bhakti ultimately has its object inside. Now, I'm sure this sounds very odd to many of you, and it should, because it's a very radical teaching. It's not an ordinary teaching, but this is exactly the kind of teaching that we find in this Narad Bhakti Sutra. It's not an ordinary text. It's an extraordinary text. So let us proceed now and see how this text unfolds what is bhakti, saying that its true object, obviously, devotion for God, but is it God who is the Uparvala, the one up there, or is it the God who dwells within? Let us begin to develop that. In our next class, I'll have some texts to hand out. Today, I'm just going to write one or two sutras on the board. They're very brief, and we have plenty to talk about just with the first one or two sutras, and I think that's all we'll see in this evening's class. First sutra. Bhaktim Vyakhya Syamaha. Repeat after me, please.
Atato bhaktim, atato bhaktim, vyakhyasyamaha.
The first of the 84 sutras. Sutra literally means thread, but it refers here to these very small cryptic statements that are used. They're not cryptic, they're very precise, almost like acronyms. Acronyms, just putting letters in a few letters, you can communicate a pretty sophisticated idea in a few letters. When we're talking with our teenagers here, one of their favorite acronyms is ABCD. American born confused Daisy. Now, ABCD, just four letters, that's a fairly complicated concept conveyed through those four letters. You can say a lot in four letters. Here, these sutras are almost like those acronyms. It conveys a lot, like shorthand. All right. It begins atta, breaking apart the first two words. Atta, attaha are the first two words. They're run together. First word is atta. Atta means now. Atta is, I should mention very briefly for those of you who study a lot, there are sutras in many traditions. There are Vedanta sutras. There are Karma Mimamsa sutras. There are Yoga sutras. Each of these are compilations of a list of these very short statements, very famous texts, they're defining texts and very analytic texts. All of them begin with atta. Atta means now. It's also a form of prayer. In a very scholarly way, atta is an auspicious statement. The rule is you shouldn't begin any text without a prayer. But many texts will very explicitly have a prayer. A whole verse will be a prayer. In some texts, many verses will be there at the beginning of the text as a prayer. Here, in one very brief word, atta, meaning now, is an auspicious sound or an auspicious word. Invoking God's blessings means now. What do you mean by now? When? Now means when, and that brings us to the next word. The next word is ataha. Atta means thereafter, hereafter, actually. That doesn't sound like it makes one sense. Now, hereafter? Now is after. And that makes some sense. Now is after what? After coming home from work, after whatever you had to do earlier today. So now means it's a time that follows another time. This word ataha, in the other sutras, in the Vedanta sutras, in the Bhakti sutras, in the Karma Mimamsa sutras of Jaimini, in all of these, all of them start with the same atta, ataha. And it has the same meaning in every case, and it means that the study of this Bhakti sutra now comes only after. The study of Bhakti sutra now comes after. After what? It comes after recognizing that kama is not enough, that prema is not enough. Only then will you seek bhakti. If kama were enough, you wouldn't be here. If prema were enough, you wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here. None of us would be here. The fact that one takes to a spiritual path can only be because one has sensed the limitations of what you can accomplish through worldly life. And that's all very complicated principle communicated in that second word, ataha, hereafter. So after recognizing that no matter how much kama you fulfill, you won't be utterly content and complete. No matter how much prema you have, you still won't be content and complete. The only way to seek fullness, the only way to seek an unbroken contentment and peace in life is through the pursuit of bhakti, through the pursuit of spiritual growth in general, and in the context of this text, through pursuing bhakti. So, atha, atato, here, now, ataha, ataha, ata, now, ataha, hereafter. So after recognizing the limitations of what you can accomplish through worldly life, what you can get through pursuing kama and artha, kama and prema, excuse me. So then what are we going to do? So the author, Narada, says, bhaktim vyakhyasyamaha. So vyakhyasyamaha is a future tense verb. Vakya means explanation. Vyakhyasyamaha is a plural future tense verb. We will explain. Vyakhyasyamaha means we will explain. What will we explain? Bhaktim. We will explain now what is bhakti. Sometimes what is not said is interesting. He says he's going to give you a vakya, not a bhashya. Sometimes vyakya is usually translated as an explanation as opposed to a definition. Let's look at it like that. He's not going to define bhakti because definitions always fall short of the mark. If you try to define the English word love, pretty difficult. Better to explain it. If you try to define anything in life, definitions are very narrow, rigid, short-sighted. So he doesn't say he's going to define bhakti, vyakhyasyamaha. He says, we will explain. And this we is kind of the formal we. There's only one person speaking to us here through this text, but the plural is used in a very formal way. We will explain bhakti, having recognized the limitations of what can be achieved through worldly life. Okay. Again, when you do have questions, then by all means, either email me, put the questions in that box, and that'll be a nice way to incorporate, because I know questions will come up in the course of this class, and it just won't work very well to take questions from the floor. Second sutra. This pen is going. We'll be talking about this for some time. Sa tvasmin parama prema rupa. Repeat after me, please. Sattvasmin, sattvasmin, parama prema rupa, parama prema rupa. Sa is a pronoun that. And it refers to the word bhakti in the prior verse. So that what? That bhakti. So he's going to begin to define right away, what do we mean by bhakti? First verse says, we are going to explain what is bhakti. Now it says sa, that bhakti. But in a class like this, it's nice to use any opportunity we can to dig a little deeper. This is a wonderful style of teaching, of course, a style that I had the great blessing of learning from my guru. Yeah, but it's a common technique that sometimes it's fun to take a little detour. So let's take a quick detour just with this word sa, and the detour is based on a very trivial observation that sa happens to be a pronoun in stri linga. It's feminine. It's a feminine pronoun, that. The pronoun that has a masculine form, a feminine form, and a neuter form. And gender counts in these texts. In fact, when we come to the next word, you're going to find an even more important comment about gender. So the grammar is important. Grammar is not unimportant. Sa bhakti, that bhakti, that devotion. Why should the word bhakti be a feminine noun? Nouns in Sanskrit can be feminine, masculine, or neuter. And usually, they for a reason. You know, that is, they reflect the inherent gender, often, of the actual object. Of course, sometimes the connection is a little bit arbitrary, and we find, and as most of you know, this gender typing of Sanskrit finds its way into modern Indian languages, including Hindi, and sometimes, you know, as a very poor speaker of Hindi, I get confused all the time because I don't know the gender of all these words. So you start with, if you're talking about roti, is it maine roti khaya? Maine roti khayi. Now you know what sounds right. I have no idea what sounds right. One is I ate roti. But is it a feminine word or a neuter word or a masculine word, or just a funny comment? Why should a gadi be feminine? Your car. Yeah, it's arbitrary, but gadi is feminine for whatever reason. Okay, bhakti is feminine for a good reason. Now share with you a delightful anecdote or story, a teaching story that Sri Ramakrishna used. I don't frequently quote Sri Ramakrishna, but this is a nice one. This one I like very much. One of his disciples asked this very question. And why is bhakti feminine? And we find in the tradition of bhakti, we find a lot of emphasis on the feminine. We find the gopis that chased after Sri Krishna, you know, this embodiment of the feminine, great bhaktas, that when you ask great bhaktas, who comes to mind, often Mira and others come to mind. And we'll talk about this more in future classes, but there seems to be, in the devotional traditions, when talking about bhakti, there's some focus on the feminine. The way Sri Ramakrishna explained it was particularly delightful. He told his disciples, gave a contemporary example. Contemporary for Sri Ramakrishna was 100-some years ago. So in that Bengali culture, I guess, in that Bengali culture, was highly conditioned by Islam, Muslim culture, which meant one of the ways when different cultures live side by side, generally they rub off on each other. One of the traditions that throughout India had rubbed off to some extent on some Hindu families is this tradition of keeping women protected. I mean, totally protected. You know, you see the extreme today in repressive Islamic communities like the Afghanistan under the Taliban, where ladies
you know, if the lady walked out of their door without her burqa, they'd throw her in jail or beat her. Right? This is what they used to do. So you can imagine in Sri Ramakrishna's time, some of these cultural traditions about keeping women protected were very much in play, including keeping women in this what is the word that would be used for it? Antapuram. Right, that's the word I'm looking for. Antapuram. It means, I guess, in the architecture of many big homes were such that you'd enter into a fairly public area, and then you'd go further into the house into a semi-public area. But in the far back of the house, don't go there. Off limits. This is where the ladies lived. This was the antapuram. So not only is it where the ladies lived, the only man who was allowed to go in there, I suppose, was the husband, the master of the house, and it was off limits to any other man, but not to any other woman. So no other man could go back into antapuram, but any woman who had a reason to go back there would be permitted to enter into that inner compartment, that hidden, that separate compartment. So the way Sri Ramakrishna explained, making use of this metaphor, he says, it is as though Paramatma, God, is in the antapuram. You see where this is going? This is a metaphor. And by the way, metaphors are not to be taken as literal truth. They're suggestive, they're poetic, and it's like this. So the way he explained it, it's as though Paramatma, God, is in the antapuram. This is not in the house, it's inside here. So if Bhagavan is in the antapuram, you want to go and discover that Bhagavan. Problem is, only women are permitted to go into that antapuram. So he said, this is how he explained bhakti being a feminine word. Now, there, you know, it's not just all fun and silliness. There's actually a very I think a very profound principle illustrated like this. The prototypical masculine way of doing things. Do it. Just do it. That kind of very straightforward, aggressive push ahead. And this statement acknowledges that it might not work. Women, as we've all discovered, are a little more subtle in their ways, a little more skillful, perhaps, in many ways, and how they handle situations and how they handle people. And perhaps Sri Ramakrishna had this observation in mind. And that is, this frontal attack is not likely to get you into the antapuram. You're going to have to be a little more subtle, a little bit more clever. Of course, knowing the teachings of Vedanta, that's so true. Just to end, just before we go on, just to make one Vedanta connection here. You know, the typical male approach in Vedanta is, what do I have to do to get enlightened? Tell me what to do. Because, you know, I'm a typical male, I'm conditioned to do things, you just tell me what to do, I can do it and do it well. Tell me what to do. Of course, if you understand enough Vedanta, you understand that Bhagavan is already here, your true nature is already Satchidananda Atma, you don't have to do anything. You are already what you want to become. You already possess what you want to gain. Therefore, doing is not the solution, suggesting a more subtle approach. So you get it. It's actually it sounds kind of silly when we start off, but it ends up being a pretty profound observation. That is, what we seek in spiritual life is not going to be achieved through conventional means. Try harder, work harder, push ahead, do this technique, do this practice. There must be something a little more subtle involved. So that's why Sri Ramakrishna suggested that bhakti is like that female, that woman, because only that woman is permitted into that antahpuram, that inner compartment. All right, enough of that. Sattu. We have two words run together here. The words are tu and asmin. Tu means but. Asmin means in this. Two, but. The word, the English word but, distinguishes one thing from another. If you're having a discussion going, yeah, in fact, when you're talking, having a little argument or debate or dispute, person's been going on talking for about 10 minutes, and you want to introduce your own point of view, what is the first word you often use? But. So, but is a word used to introduce a different point of view, a different perspective. What is a different perspective being introduced here? But. What is different from kama and different from prema? So, on the other, but, or you can translate it more elaborately as on the other hand, bhakti is totally different from kama and prema. So, two, but, it's very different. And what is it? It is parama prema rupa. Rupa, one whose form or whose nature. Whose nature. Rupa literally means form. But bhakti is that whose rupa, whose form or nature is prema, love. But what kind of love? Parama, which we joked about in the last class, supreme. The joke in our last class, for those of you who missed, was the most common usage of supreme in modern America is when you go to the service station for gasoline and you can fill it up regular or supreme. A better meaning for supreme, even this word parama uspar, subsepar, that which is beyond, that which is beyond everything. That to say beyond everything means having no boundary, no limit, no condition. So that adjective parama, prema means love. But here, prema is connected with the adjective parama. Parama means having no boundary, having no limit, having no condition. You could truly translate parama prema as limitless love, boundaryless love, unconditional love. So here we're translating bhakti, or he's beginning to explain bhakti by saying sa. That bhakti is parama prema rupa. That bhakti is characterized as unconditional love, boundaryless love, limitless love. And that cannot be a feeling. If we say love is a feeling, you know what it feels to love, you know what it feels to be loved. You know what it feels like to love a lot. You know what it feels like to love a tremendous amount. If you think of your love for parents, for children, for those that you deeply care about in life, you know what that love feels like. Is it infinite? It's a lot. It's a whole lot. But infinite is not a big word. Infinite is more than big. Whatever you think, infinite is more than that. That's why the word limitless or boundaryless are so important. That which has no constriction, nothing to confine it, nothing to limit it. So, parama prema rupa sa bhaktim, sa bhaktihi. So the bhakti that we're going to discuss in this text is not the emotion of love, but it is a kind of love which is infinite, boundaryless, unconditioned. And the hidden secret in this verse is the last word. Love or devotion for whom? Said before, what's interesting sometimes is often what is not said. So you'd think that if you were going to write a text on bhakti, you'd probably define it very similarly. You'd say that bhakti is this unconditional, infinite, boundaryless love for God. Good. Does he say boundaryless, infinite love for God? No. He says boundaryless, infinite love for this. Love in this. Love to this one. He uses a pronoun. First of all, it's a pronoun. He does not say God, does not say Bhagavan, does not say Ishvara, does not say Paramatma, does not say Parabrahma. He says, gives you the pronoun in this. And further, remember we talked about gender before? He uses a neuter pronoun. Huh. What happened to God? Instead of God, we have this neuter pronoun, supreme love in this. He refuses to name the one to whom the devotion is directed. Do you think that's accidental? Absolutely not. This is part of the brilliance of this text. This is an extraordinary text, which is why it's been studied for so many centuries. Suppose he had said Ishvara, or Bhagavan, or Paramatma. Any word that the author might have used here would limit the one to whom the devotion is ultimately directed. The moment you put a name on God, we've limited God. If we use the English word God, that word limits who and what the source of the cosmos truly is. If we use Sanskrit words, Bhagavan, Ishvara, we've limited the one who it truly is. If we use words from other religions, Yahweh, Allah, whatever word we use, we are limiting that God of the cosmos. So if you want to really write a brilliant text, you wouldn't want to start off by limiting the one that you're going to be talking about. So the author brilliantly here chooses not to put a name. Any name limits. And just to take this a little step further, we're obviously in future classes, we have to talk about not just bhakti, but the one to whom this divine love is directed. In our discussions, we're going to find out that whatever is your concept of the God of the universe, any concept you have is less than who it truly is. Any concept is less. Therefore, how will you reach to that ultimate truth of God by giving up all concepts? This is a very Vedantic approach to bhakti, obviously. Now, in future classes, we have to talk about, well, if the ultimate way to God is to give up all concepts of God, why do we have these deities on our altar? And as we proceed, we're going to be distinguishing between, better introduce these terms, we're going to distinguish between sadhana bhakti and sadhya bhakti. Sadhana and sadhya. Sadhana is a means, a practice, a technique. Sadhya is the goal. And in future classes, we'll develop that there are these two aspects to bhakti. There is bhakti, which is sadhana, which is a means to an end. There's another kind of bhakti, which is sadhya, the goal. And from tonight's discussion, we're talking about the sadhya bhakti, the ultimate bhakti called parama prema rupa, the bhakti which is unconditioned, and the bhakti which is towards a God who cannot be limited by any words or ideas. So at this highest level, your pursuit of God will become fruitful only when you give up all concepts of who that God is. All of our concepts are inadequate. So to come closer to that God, we have to drop all those concepts. This is the sadhya bhakti. Then to answer my question, why do we have the deities on the altar? This is part of sadhana bhakti. This is part of the devotional tradition, which is a means to the end. It's not the end, it's not the goal. It's a stepping stone. You think about it as a stepping stone. This is a principle we'll be developing at great length in coming classes. So there are two things significant about why he chose the pronoun asmin instead of a name for God. One is to avoid using a name, to avoid limiting that God in any way with a name or concept. There's a second reason for using this pronoun. This pronoun also happens to be the proximate pronoun. There are two kinds of pronouns. One is a pronoun you use for something away from you, remote. There's another kind of pronoun you use for something nearby. The difference between if I say that wall and this wall, so that wall is a wall that's remote. This wall is a wall that's not remote. This is the proximate pronoun, the near pronoun, in this. Not in that, in this. We were joking before about devotion to the Uparvala, the God up there in the heavens. That's clearly not what Narada, the author of this text, is talking about. We're talking about devotion not to a God who is out there somehow in some loka, in some realm far away from us, looking down upon us with compassion, showering down his grace upon us. These concepts have beauty and value as sadhana bhakti. They're nice in stories. They help us. They inspire us. But clearly, that's not who and what this text is talking about. Not a God out there, but a God who is present here, asmin, in this. Parama prema rupa, boundaryless, limitless love to this. And here, to this, ultimately, and we'll see this as we continue in future classes, means to the God of the universe who is present within us all, here and now. The God of the universe who is present in and through everything in the universe. This is a lot to talk about. This is a vision of the ancient Rishi. So I think we'll finish with just a few concluding remarks now. But you can see what we're in for is not a very conventional discussion of bhakti. So he starts right off by challenging us to understand, first of all, bhakti not as an emotional kind of love, but as something utterly different than the emotion of love. And secondly, devotion for whom? And now we'll be challenged to give up to give up all of our concepts and names for God and transcend all of that. So we have some very significant challenges ahead as we continue our text. A couple of brief announcements here at the end of our class. Next class, I will have the text. We'll hand out the text so you can all have a copy of it, and we'll continue seeing these sutras.
I'll give you a quick reminder of ongoing programs. Since in fall we just restarted a bunch of programs, we restarted our Sanskrit class. Those of you who'd like to study Sanskrit, we have the intermediate Sanskrit class. It just started. So the reason I'm mentioning it one more time is you still have chance to join us, because after another week or two, it'll keep moving along and there's no way you'll be able to catch up. So if you've already, it's an intermediate class, not a beginning class. So if you already have studied a little bit of Sanskrit, you'll probably be able to fit in. So you're welcome to join us on Monday nights at 7:30. This coming Friday, we're having an informal satsang, question-answer session. It's nice. It's important, in fact, to include some very casual. And nice also in a smaller, more intimate setting. We can hang out as it were. Oh, I was at the reason I use that term, Sunday I have a class at the Hindu temple in Allentown for their children. They have about 100 children. And I do some satsang for the whole group. So I started off with the whole group, 100 children. How to explain what is satsang? And I said, sat means good person. Sangha means association. So association with a good person, but that sounds so formal. How about this? I told the kids, satsang means hanging out with cool people. they like that definition. So we will have our satsang this coming Friday at 7:30. A week from Friday, we have our guest lecture, and our guest lecture this month will be Dr. Yagnya Subramaniam. Many of you know of him. He's a very respected teacher in our community, one of the founders of the Bridgewater Temple and many other things. So we'll have an opportunity to listen to him a week from Friday. Saturday, as usual, Bhagavad Gita classes. Sunday, I'll remind you, there's a meditation workshop at 9 o'clock, and meditation is a very helpful practice. If you don't already have a practice of meditation going, I really encourage you to attend the workshop. And then we'll have, of course, our programs for teenagers and children on this Sunday. There's some yellow flyers on the board that has all the information on children and teens. We'll end in just a moment with our prayers, and we'll have the library open after the prayers. But before we do that, we could use some help. We're getting the old building. We're doing some remodeling. So along with the connection between the two buildings, we're remodeling the old hall, and we're getting ready to remodel what was our old foyer over there. We have a bunch of furniture to move. We could use about a half a dozen volunteers immediately after class to join me in the old foyer where you used to keep your shoes. And in 10 minutes, we just have to move some furniture, which we're going to move into the old basement. I'll join you over there. So we need about a half a dozen volunteers, and should only take 10 minutes. I appreciate your help. We'll conclude with our prayers.